I don't know. I grew up on a farm. Most of us did at the time. Like some sort of like, a garden, some animals. Basic.
So now we're like concerned about.
How many more minutes do we got?
Technically none.
Yeah.
I'm from the Green Party of New Mexico. Background natural resources management and policy. Worked real hard with regards to global conditions over the years. 28 years ago, I sat on the dais with Dr. William Kellogg, who was one of the first climatologists to actually speak about global climate change with regards to greenhouse gases. And along with me, with him, were about four other PhDs from Los Alamos, Sandia Laboratories, UC Poly, and myself. Why was I the lone person out there? Because I owned a solar business. I wrote as guest editor for Alternative Source of Energy magazine on the future of photovoltaics. At that point in time, almost everything that I've spoken about has come true. From what was written over 28 years ago is now fact, and it's now truth with regards to where the photovoltaics industry is. So welcome on it. I'd like to dream of a future that's better than the history of the past. I know that a lot of folks are looking at what we can do in the future. And for our standpoint, we have our Green Party platform. And in regards to democracy, social justice, ecology, and peace, what we're actually looking at is some key relevant statements out of our party platform, which is human societies must function with the understanding that we are part of nature, not separate from nature. We have to maintain an ecological balance, live within inside of ecological and resource limits of communities and our planet. Support a sustainable society. It doesn't say what type. It doesn't say capitalist or socialist. It says a society. Okay. that utilize resources in such a way that future generations will benefit and not suffer from the practices of our generation. Those of you who looked at both the extremes of socialism, state-sponsored, as well as capitalism, corporate-sponsored, know what the problems are when we go with those isms. To this end, though, we have to practice agriculture, replenishes our soil, moves to an energy-efficient economy, and live in ways that respect the integrity of natural systems. One of my favorites, as far as a person that worked on this, was our Buckminster Fuller. Wrote a really good seminal piece called The Grunch of Giants, which is great to go look at. But he says there's absolutely no reason why we have to have the wars. We have the ability to go out and make sustainable societies all around the world, and I still believe in that. It's an altruistic behavior, but it's something that we all have to look at. So on personal and global responsibility, which is why you're here today, because Thoreau spoke about personal responsibility. We encourage individuals to act to improve their personal well-being at the same time to enhance ecological balance and social harmony. Seek to join with people and organizations around the world to foster peace, economic justice, and the health of the planet. And we were speaking yesterday about, what did Thoreau talk about? He says, well, on his essay on civil disobedience, when he's inside the prison, Emerson came to visit him. And Emerson said, what are you doing in there? And he said, what are you doing out there? So, I mean, if you want to go and have economic justice, et cetera, you have to go out and stand up for everybody's rights, and that's basically what he did. So, and I thought it was great that Standing Rock went there with a number of people from New Mexico to bring up supplies, et cetera, but it was a geodesic dome that was there. So what are we looking at? Well, the whole interest of our reason or speculative as well as practical is centered in the three following questions. What can I know about this subject of global climate change? We know it's drastic. What ought I to do? That's what everybody's like, I don't know what to do, please help me, you know. Please save me, government, save me, okay. And then what may I basically hope for the future? So on the future focus and sustainability, it happens to be in our platform statement, is our actions and policies should be motivated by long-term goals, seek to protect the valuable natural resources, safely dispose of unmaking of all of our waste that we create, developing a sustainable economics is not dependent upon continual expansion for survival. In other words, we're talking about a negative GDP, not a positive GDP. Positive GDP is gone. Anybody who starts talking to you, well, we need to raise the GDP, you say, okay, so Fukushima added to the GDP. It also killed off the Pacific Ocean, you know, as far as practical intents and purposes. It destroyed the chitin on the base of the food chain, and now we're all having to go out and deal with the problem of less protein availability worldwide from just even fisheries or seaweed, et cetera. The heat is on. These are the folks that I ended up sitting on down with. I felt kind of bare, because all I had was a BS and MS. Everybody else had their PhDs. But what they found was that all of a sudden they found this great warming portion of the ocean, world's ocean. And they said, oh my God, we didn't hardly expect that temperature raise to increase, to happen at that point in time. This is back in 1986. So what are we looking at now? Well, most of our world has been inside of these two boundary lines as far as the Holocene time period all the way up to where we're the Anthropocene, where we are living. And all of a sudden, this is what we found human beings being able to go and survive in. And then here at this 1 degree Celsius rise that we all of a sudden got, we just went, oh my God, we're outside the boundary zone of where humans used to live. Well, it's even going worse. What we're looking at is going up to 5 degrees Celsius. I think we got a misspelling there. All right, there we go. So where does that end up looking at on a particular graph? Well, this is one by Michael Mann. He wrote an incredibly great book called Dire Predictions. And it would be one to go ahead and read. I'll give you a bibliography before you leave so that you have basically all references that you need for today. But what he looked at is that this was back that little hump, that Holocene period, and then this is that 1 degree bump that we ended up seeing already. But he said on the basis of the projections and everything that we've got out there right now, the basic modeling, is all of this overshoots. When does this first major overshoot happen with a 2 degrees Celsius degree rise? They estimate by 2036. How old will you be then?
Alive anyway.
Alive anyway. So here's the thing. If you look at what we're doing as far as being alive, we generally go ahead and look at day-to-day risks. What is the risk of us not doing something? Okay. Whereas Jared Diamond, who's the person who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel, he also wrote the book Collapse, Why Civilizations Choose to Fail. And in one of his TED Talks, he spoke about how is it that we're working with our risk. He said, I got to this place as an ornithologist up in Papua New Guinea, and I'm sitting and I see this beautiful tree. I decide to go out and camp out underneath, nice and flat area. All the locals go and say, we're camping out in the open. So why? He said, well, look up in the tree. There's a dead limb over there. He said, well, we can't afford that risk of having one of our members of our society be underneath there and have that piece of tree fall down on us. We're in that same situation. We don't see the dead limb coming down on us. You know, we're just saying, well, we're kind of awake, but not really. So, how bad is it getting? The global emissions from the fossil fuel and industry alone, which represents over 60%, has been taking some major spikes. These time periods of 3% a year in global emissions almost track, if I were to overlay a chart that showed what China was doing in terms of use of fossil fuels, it would almost go right over this time, this graph that we have. It's kind of slowed a little bit, but it's still going up at, they estimate, 2% per year, which is huge.
CO2 is emissions?
Yes, CO2 is emissions in gigatons. So what is our problem? Is our problem is now we don't have very much of a budget left because everything else has been going on an upswing. So we're looking at, we've already factored in this, the deforestation, cement production. Some cement places are shutting down now. Non-CO2 forcing, which is what's already in the atmosphere by CFCs, et cetera. And what might happen with the permafrost carbon releases that already start happening at 1 degree plus. So they're saying we don't have very much of a budget. We could use it up by 2025. And as I said, 2038 is what they said is basically you drive off a cliff with the rest of the lemmings. And it's driving off the cliff. You're not jumping off because everybody's still driving, right? Okay. So some of the outlines of solutions on there that James Hansen spoke about was that coal in, only in the power plants with sequestration. In other words, you have to have another rule on the books in terms of how they're going to end up handling their use. Or it's old technology, so you bulldoze it down. In New Mexico, we reduced by over 50% the global the emissions from one of our major power plants. It's a mega polluter in terms of coal. And it's still on the decline. We probably would lose a lot of people's working. Stretch the conventional oil and gas by incentives. In other words, don't go ahead and start doing more drilling, more fracking. Look at cap or tax. Address the non-CO2 climate forcing, the methane, et cetera. And I think I have some solutions for that. I've been talking with some scientists in the last couple of weeks with regards to coastal redwoods, believe it or not. And draw down the atmospheric CO2 by agricultural and forestry practices, biofuel-powered plants. And this comes from the Global Climate Project. So how's the U.S. doing in comparison to everybody else? It sucks.
No.
To put it quite bluntly. Our good friends in Denmark, they're on track to do a 40% reduction in their fossil fuel usage, in their carbon emissions, actually, by 2020. They started that in 1990. They ruled basically by consensus in their parliament, making the decision and making that they needed to do. And us from 1990, and if I were to project this on out, there's been a little slight decline, not much, but for the most part, this is still basically status quo. We've made no changes from 1990 in the United States. And we've offshored a lot of our emissions because they've gone to China, et cetera. So what are our solutions? What do we ought to do? How many of you get Green American? Occasionally, okay. In the front, I have a whole stack of Green American with Paul Hawkins' article in there, so please go ahead and take one. It's excellent. If you want to go take two, feel free. I think it's a great article. So I just said basically two items. You've got to stop putting the greenhouse gases up there, bring them back home to Earth. What does our party platform call for? Well, by 2020, we're supposed to be down 40%, like what Denmark is. This should be front page news, that the Green Party has called out for this and has not happened. The promises that were given by the other parties are not coming true. As a matter of fact, they're making the problems worse. So what can we do to get a reduction that's down to 5%? Because some of them are saying because of the stuff that's baked in the cake right now that we'll overshoot anyway. Well, how about this one? Eliminating 544 million fossil fuel passenger vehicles off the road. That's one way of doing it. We could do it all at once. Okay, just get rid of all the cars. Or we can go and switch all of our light bulbs out to LEDs. But that's not going to work, right? I mean, nobody's going to do, you know, everybody in the same time. Yes?
Well, to get them off the road, if we were to help promote things like automated vehicles that are electronic, like maybe helping someone like Elon Musk promote, then maybe we could work towards something like that.
It might. It might. If you hold on to the questions right now so we get through with the sun. So what are our solutions, really? Well, it's individuals, societal, and politically. Those are three items. So we're looking at is individuals from the standpoint of Thoreau and his necessities of life. And when people get together, society around opportunity and possibility, not the probability of disaster, that's where we come in and do our outreach, whether it's community work as Greens, and we're just present. We don't have to go out and always bang the drum, but we're just there. People recognize after a while that you're there. And the way to address the global warming is to address the current human needs. Like Dee will be speaking with regards to the shelter needs that people have and how that actually works to go ahead and reduce a little bit of our climate problems. So Paul Hawkins, in his book called Drawdown, he gave us 100 different reasons of hope for climate, hundreds of scientists working on it, vetted by over 100, and said, this is what we can go ahead and do that can draw down the amount of fossil fuels that we are consuming. Two of them are what he calls no-regret solutions, that is nuclear power, and the other one being waste to energy. He says those are totally kind of like almost unacceptable at this point in time, considering its past history. So where are we at as our individual per capita? This is the United States here with our overall population, China in here, Europe, India, etc. In 1986, when I did my first set of calculations on this, in New Mexico alone, we were responsible for about 13.3 tons of emissions per year. And now the average in the U.S. is up over 16. So I'll give you an idea of that. That graph that I showed with regards to the upward curve at a 3% per year, what happened? How come we're driving? You know, what's causing the driving of all this stuff? Well, I used to think that it was something as innocuous as plug it in, plug it in. You know, did you ever hear that?
Plug it in, plug it in. Plug it in, plug it in.
And you can have from Johnson Wax Company a little vial that would go and you plug it in.
Yeah.
And it's 1.5 watts and I...
Glade, right?
Glade, oh, exactly, right. Yeah. So if you multiply that times all the households in the United States, all of a sudden you found out that you were looking at two nuclear power plants. Just with one consumer
marketing
tool, right? So how about going back to basics? All right. Henry David Thoreau and his necessaries. I know it's the way he spelled it, so I'm not going to say anything. By the words necessary of life, I mean food. He said water too in there. Shelter, clothing, and fuel. For not until we have secured those are we prepared to entertain the true problems of life with freedom and a prospect for any success. Brilliant. It's That's what you get for sitting not in the woods. And it, he didn't have a solar oven like I did, though. So what can we do? Well, we have a checklist for our necessities of life. And the drawdowns that are directly from Hansen's book. And Hansen gave it a ranking. All right, so if you're going down the list on here, we've just gone ahead and divided on up into different segments on it, on food, clothing, shelter, and fuel. And we came up with the totals for each particular section in terms of drawdown and the rankings on it. Just to let you know, households are only about, you know, 1/4 of the energy usage in the country, if we look at it directly of what's in, under your direct hand-to-hand control. But in this particular case, it gives you at least some guidelines as to where you might be able to go. So first one is, reduce your food waste. It's number 3 in solutions on it. Every year, 40% of the stuff goes on out to waste at this point in time. And part of it has to do with refrigerators and going to Costco and all that stuff. You know, it's like you buy by the bulk and you stick it in the refrigerator, and then 2 years later, you go, oh, it's way past the expiration date. So we can go ahead and start doing a little bit more concern with regards to our food usage. And I thought Denmark did fairly well. In a show in 2013 called Bogen, which is a political show, which I highly recommend, almost every single home showed a refrigerator in it. And the refrigerator was a Euro refrigerator, about 4 square foot. Footprint total. Even the Prime Minister's house. So are you going to put a lot of stuff in there if there's a problem? No, not much. But next item, go and support plant-rich diet. Yes?
No, I'm saying, yeah.
Okay, cool, all right. This is a vegan dessert fundraiser we had in Albuquerque, so we were sitting down with the vegan folks on it, and it's pretty amazing stuff. I mean, I ate about half of that plate. Had to try everything. You know, so. But it's number 4 in the solutions. It has a very good greenhouse gas reductions. Or you can grow some of your own food that's done ecologically, and it doesn't have to always be that the chickens has the you know what cut off. But in this particular case, my chickens, which I had 11 of them, the eggs were given to my neighbors. The chickens got to roam the yard, they picked out all the bugs for me, they go out and they pooped, and they provided some instantaneous fertilizer, and it worked out great. So, and most of them have all died of old age now. I've got 3 left, and it seems to work. So we can talk about regenerative agriculture as being part of this whole thing of growing your own food. So do what you can to sequester that carbon into your own soil, even in your own yard. It's a good thing. You can also do conservation agriculture, you know, preserving the soil moisture and the humus, etc. For your information, I used to work for Soil Conservation Service back in the day, up on the high plains where there wasn't hardly anything in terms of soil left. But this is the source of the community garden, and this is what it was looking like when we first get started for the year. And this is what it looks like just a week ago. So the amaranth is up, the corn's up, the tomatoes are up. And we show people that this is just a transition. You can come out here, sit, look, and help us on out with the garden. And it's great. Everybody gets into the whole game of working together. You can also do tree intercropping. Now, one of the first places I saw this was done successfully was in a place called Village Homes in Davis, California. Davis, California has a community on what they originally wanted to do is a massive subdivision the same way. But what they did is reduce the size of the overall urban streets on down from about 34 feet down to 20 to 24 feet. And that whole area that was given up on either side was given up for trees, for the most part. So it shaded the roadway surface, but also any of the runoff on there, it went to water all the trees. And the trees were what type? Not ornamentals. They were all food producing. So we need to get into the same mode, and if you have cities that are not doing food production on its sidewalk areas because somebody wants to go and say something about, you know, slipping on a piece on it, yes, there is a problem with that. But we have to go ahead and start doing something, and our communities are the first place that we can go ahead and make a change. So get a dialogue going. Figure out how it can happen. Okay. We can do composting at home, and that's a good solution. Water savings on it. Everybody has done this already, at least I hope you have. You changed out your toilet as it got older and for one that's more efficient. You've done the drip irrigation for you out of doors. For clothing, you can make some changes too. Mills produce clothing, not that Mankind may be well and honestly clad, but unquestionably the corporation may be enriched. Henry David Thoreau again. Warnwear is something that's done by Patagonia Corporation. But what we can do as individuals, at least purchase and support the growing of bamboo and hemp. It's number 35 in the solutions. In a longer program, I've got a little bit of discussion as to what's good and what's bad about this, because I worked at cannabis grow in Northern California with getting their final permit application in Humboldt County. So I know what some of the issues are that are involved with this. This one happens to be in Vermont, hemp that's licensed for growing for not recreational use, but for fiber and the CBD oils. So support the companies that offer industrial cycling of clothing. That's number 56 in solutions. For fuel, you can look at homemade electricity and tell your utility to go take a hike. You can do some rooftop solar. After you've made some other savings, you can go with this. This is my house in Albuquerque, and did this 13 years ago, and have been getting a check every month ever since, except one. We can use mass transit, and one of the things you can do is with your council of governments, work together to try to get the national high-speed rail system up and running. And demand it. Go to those meetings. If you don't go to the meetings, you don't get anywhere. You have to be there, and you have to be there with other people saying the same thing. And ours from Albuquerque, we're looking at Phoenix, Albuquerque, Denver. That's a major range area we're looking at getting some work done.
But how much of a problem have you had with, like, eminent domain? And
they took us off the list. We're no longer on the national list for going from Phoenix. Because what they did is they disempowered the community by taking them off of the Council of Governments Public Involvement Committee.
But I mean, in terms of the high-speed rail, I mean, California, we're having a terrible time with them, just decimating communities.
Well, there's issues involved with having to go ahead and move people. So we either widen the freeways, which also is a social justice issue because they normally stick it through where? Poorest communities, the most unfavored quarter.
Do you know about solutionary rail? It's about creating an electrical rail line that moves both people and cargo that actually has renewable energy feeding into it and serves also as a conduit for the energy. So check it out, Solutionary Rail.
Okay, will do.
I just sent those to our whole climate commission in Maryland.
The other one is with regards to bicycling issues. And in 1994, we got the first ordinance passed in Albuquerque for bicycling. We had about 3 miles worth, maybe 4 miles worth of bicycle trails. If you want to, I've got a couple of them right now. The infrastructure, I call it better than Boulder. One trail alone is completely grade separated. It's about 20 some odd miles long from the north end to the south end of the city. So Lewis Mumford said, just get our legs back, right? And for fuel on it, also solar hot water heating. This is one thing I haven't done. My own house, it's a little bit problematic. I have to redo a roof in order to put it in and incorporate it. But, you know, you're alive when you're doing all these things. You're actually participating in the day-to-day of your own life, so get to work on it. Be right with you on that.
We're going to have to take questions at the end, because we've got 30 minutes left, and you still...
Yeah. Shelter insulation. We found that zero-net energy homes could be done. Our speaker here from Department of Energy was the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, and we knew already 20, almost 30 years ago, we had the computer programs for you to go and figure out how much passive solar, active and passive you could have to actually design yourself a zero net energy house. And we found that even for Las Cruces, New Mexico, which is about the same latitude as Tucson, Arizona, that it was cost effective to put in R50 in the ceilings of the homes, which is normally what you would consider putting in Minnesota. Switching out the lighting systems, I did that. That was one of the first places I saw massive savings, and I did that with just the old folded tube fluorescent lamps. You can build with low energy materials such as alternative cement. What I just need to go and tell you is that we knew about this stuff already in the 1970s, 1980s, that the indigenous materials that people were using were the most energy least intensive. Adobe would be like 2,500 BTUs per brick, and you'd be looking at a cinder block at being 10 times that, and a bag of Portland cement being 10 times that. You know, so there was an awful lot of energy consumption. And who is this benefiting? You know, what type of economy did we want to grow? It was a GDP based on oil and gas,
for example, and nuclear.
And a refrigeration considered. This is the size of my refrigerator at home. And it suits me perfectly well. I have a little bit of time period with people that come over every once in a while for a party. That's when I bring out the insulated boxes, and that works. You know, I put the food in there with a little bit of ice, and that's not a problem. But for the most part, I don't waste a lot of food as an end result because everything is inside of a smaller package. Very highly efficient on the refrigeration. Some of them that are out there in 12 volts will consume about 200 and some odd kilowatt hours a year. You go to sub-zero if you want the high price spread. That thing is almost 600 for the same size footprint, same size refrigerator. So it pays to go ahead and make some changes. So what we can also do as Greens is a lot. Sponsoring girls in education, push for carbon fee and dividend, look for green bonds, and sequestration. So, and there's where we are. If you want to go and put it all in perspective as to all of the work that we're not doing, okay, you're on a spaceship bound for a billion years of intergalactic travel. Imagine leaving the opportunity for hundreds of generations yet to come by your acceptance of your own individual responsibility. That is the view from Voyager leaving the solar system looking back at Earth. That's the planet. So you got a right to be here, but hey, be a little bit accountable. Join the Green Party. All right.
Thank you.
I guess you're up.
No, this isn't the right one.
Oh.
That's the wrong. You copied the wrong slides.
Oh, those are the wrong.
It's on your flash drive.
Yeah,
so.
We can
load that in there. Stevens, if you want to.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Sue, while you're putting that together, I'll just say my very brief bit.
Sure.
Okay. Good.
Are you taking questions after each speaker?
I think we want to kind of get through and then we'll have sort of more of a panel kind of a thing going on. Let me come up here. So, Dean Steven just asked me to say a few words about food. I agreed to do that because about 10 years ago, my wife and I purchased a little property in Central Virginia where we've lived since. It's about 5 acres. And most of it is wooded, a lot of wildlife, deer, bears, and all kinds of other things, foxes. But we also have about an acre of pasture, about another quarter of an acre where I have a large garden. There's room around the house for fruit trees. And I wanted to use it, this experience, both of us did, as a way of trying to really get a sense, having grown up in cities and lived in the modern world, get a sense of what it would mean to live sustainably and in cooperation with our environment. And so that's what we've been trying to learn about. We haven't succeeded in being entirely sustainable and entirely supported on our land, but that wasn't necessarily our primary goal. Our goal was really one of self-education and exploration and finding out what it involved. So this is a kind of an interesting little lesson. I planted garlic, and this was one of the ways in which nature right away told me that it has a mind of its own. Because a lot of times you plant things and something comes along and kills it almost immediately. And other times you plant something and all of a sudden you have 1,000 of them and they're everywhere. Right? And garlic is one of those. So this is a very nice stiff-necked garlic, and you can see the buds here and the garlic flowers. But if you look in the background, I didn't plant any of those. They just did it. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing when you're in nature is, you know, if you don't dump poison on it, then you have nature all around you. So the tree frogs come to visit me in the garden, and all of the, you know, the skunks come to visit, and the foxes come to visit my chickens, and it's all there. And I could take a modern approach, and using chemicals and fencing and violence, I could suppress all of that, but that wasn't the aim. The aim was, how do we regenerate what we're living in and cooperate with it, not simply exploit it for our own needs? Because globally, human beings take 83% of the net primary production in agricultural parts of the world, probably close to the theoretical maximum. And the consequence is that the natural world is dying. I don't have to tell you now all that. You already know it. So we wanted to see how we could live on a piece of property and not just cooperate, but actually help to regenerate nature. When I first dug into the hard red clay underneath the sod there where I keep my garden, we're lucky to see a worm. Now you pull up a shovel full and it bristles with worms. I use no-till regenerative methods, and the soil is getting a little darker every year as it sequesters more carbon and builds more soil life in it. So, you know, that's what we do. But I think perhaps the hardest lesson for me has been that, okay, so here are my wife and I, we're approaching retirement age, kids gone, and here we are, you know, sort of the lord and lady of this five-acre kingdom. We could easily support two growing families on that property. And that's what it would take to properly care for that property. For example, I told you I have a one-acre pasture. All I've done with that pasture is kind of let it go fallow, let it do its natural thing. But the result is that the pasture is degrading over time. That pasture is no longer healthy because I haven't kept any animals on it and there aren't enough animals around. It needs to have ruminants in order to be a healthy pasture. I could let it go back to forest, but I can't keep it as a healthy pasture unless I put ruminants on it. But that would mean, you know, there are a number of options. I could go with all kinds of different animals, but whatever I pick, it would be a sufficient amount of work to do it responsibly that my wife and I really aren't up to it at this point. With our chickens and our geese and our garden and now our beehives, we're pretty much tapped out. And this got me to thinking as I was rereading Walden on the flight over because of the theme of this talk. Thoreau missed something in among his four necessaries. And, you know, maybe it was his individualism, I don't know, but without community, that regenerative approach to agriculture isn't actually possible. Community is one of the four necessaries. It's the thing without which you can't, it's one of the sine qua non, right? And we're not alone in understanding this. There we go. The UN has been working on this question, of course, for a long, long time, and they pretty well got it figured out, in my view. If you go to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, they get that localized, sustainable, regenerative agriculture that is embedded in the biome and embedded in the community is the only real hope for feeding humanity going forward. And so we really need to add that piece in. And we need to be aware, because we tend to get a little bit prescriptive, right? With respect to my vegan friends, nature isn't only plant-based, and it depends where you are. I happen to be in Central Virginia. In Central Virginia, it's a deciduous biome. We mostly eat plants, but if we didn't have animals, as I explained about the pasture, also on the land, it wouldn't work, because that's not how nature wants to do it. Nature wants to have those animal inputs. So we have to cooperate with that in some way. And if I lived in New Mexico, it would be a different story with respect to some of those things. If I lived in Canada, it would be a different story with respect to some of those things, or in the tropics. So it has to be localized and it has to be community-based. So that's just, those were the thoughts that I developed. I just wanted to say a few words, and I'm happy to talk about it more after the other speakers. Thanks.
While they're working on this, by the way, one of the things I learned is that, especially if you're growing your own food, learning how to preserve it, and learning how to preserve it without running a freezer, yeah, that's a big piece. I've gotten really good at canning and drying.
And do you have a cold pantry?
We don't have a proper root cellar yet. It's kind of been on our to-dos, but our cellar in our house is fairly cool, and I keep a lot of stuff down there.
Could you rent out your house?
I could do. It would mean fencing it in. It's not big enough to be of interest to most of the cattle farmers around us. I have neighbors with, 20 and 30 acres of pasture, and of course they have animals rotating through on a regular basis.
I used to have a 7-acre field, and we had to deal with a local horse owner that he would come twice a year and take all and just mow it and take it all.
Yeah.
We just kind of started the process of moving our house over to zero waste, but the idea of canning is kind of scary because I heard that if you do something wrong, it can literally kill you.
Sure, but I mean the same is true of climbing a ladder.
Yeah.
If you read the science, get a good pH meter, know which things can be bath canned and which things have to be pressure canned, and take care. You're safer than you are buying stuff at the grocery store.
Okay.
Yeah. I started off being very conservative, like I would pressure can my tomatoes, right? Turns them into mush. You really want to water bath can your tomatoes, but you got to make sure the pH is low enough. If it's down below 4.5, you're fine. If not, then you can foster some botulism, and you don't want to do that. So get something to measure it with. Keep yourself safe. You're fine.
Do you share any of your experiences online?
Not yet. Not really. I'm so much in the learning phase. I don't want to come off as an authority on any of these things.
Oh yeah.
There are plenty of other resources.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi. We got through the technical. Okay. I'm Sue Peters. I want to talk about some knowledge that is not taught in our schools and basically was taken out of public discourse around 1952, very slowly. And it has to do with family farmers, which from 1952 on have slowly been driven off of their land because they don't get a price for their work, and they can't afford to keep their farms, and they're driven off. And the result of that over this long term, it's been unfortunately a governmental policy from 1952 on to slowly drive off the family farmer. And what we have in its place is corporate agriculture. So this is a piece of knowledge from an organization called the National Organization of Raw Materials, which is a group of farmers who are still hanging on and trying to get this information out. And I'm a member of their organization. I really respect what they're trying to do, and they're all farmers, so I'm on their conference call once a week, and we talk about what I'm going to talk to you about in the politics, and then they talk about what they're growing and you know, what's happening with the weather and this and that. Okay, so it's called a parity economy. Parity, there's actually parity in our national platform. There's a parody, but there's no explanation for it. So this is really an explanation for it. Okay, next. So in 1769, Benjamin Franklin observed there are three ways a nation becomes wealthy. You can make war and grab the wealth. You can trade and cheat for the wealth. Think of free trade. Or you can profit through agriculture, whereby planting a seed creates new wealth as if by a miracle. That's our new wealth every growing season. Next. So in terms of trade, a friend of mine in New York, I'm in New York, he's in Oklahoma. When we were discussing this, he said, well, look at the World Trade Center in New York. It's all about cheating. The world's traders have built this showcase, a theater, to make us think this is where wealth comes from. But it's the guy who's working down here on the farm that's created our wealth. It's just work. It's the worker. Next. So here's Norm. So what I discovered, and a friend introduced me to Norm, and I don't know if anyone has ever read the books by Charles Walters or read Acres Magazine, but Charles Walters was a major proponent of this, keeping this information alive. He started Acres, which is an eco-agriculture magazine that's still going on, in 1970. And through that magazine, he was also a scientist. He's an incredible person. He's an economist, a scientist. And it's all about helping farmers develop natural means of growing food. But he also kept this information alive in that magazine. So what is this information? Okay, Norm has knowledge that is provable. It's not theory. About how an economy works, the whole economy, not just the farming communities, and how money can be distributed as widely as possible to the owners and workers of private enterprise. And they discovered natural laws. The people who developed this knowledge, it was in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, and is actually originally begun by some farmer in Iowa who, hey, the week before he was selling his corn for like $2 a bushel, and then the next week it's like a dollar a bushel. And he said, why is this happening? Why, you know, in the middle of the Depression he said that. Why, you know, my corn is the same corn, same nutrients. But a week ago I got, more for it. Now it's like so much less. And he started this. He gathered around him economists and other people who wanted to answer this question. So they discovered the natural laws of an economy. And their teaching of parity agriculture was official policy in our federal government from 1942 to 1950. And then this neoliberal economic slowly took over public and official discourse, and it was silenced. But it's a natural law. It's not that you can, you know, change nature. Okay, next. So I ask myself, why haven't I been taught this in my education? You know, why don't they teach this? Okay, why not? Let's see. So this is some of the tenets. Agriculture must be considered the foundation of the economy of the United States. It's the nation's largest industry. It creates the biggest share of the raw material input of new wealth, in any accounting period. So this, when I learned this, I'm a city girl. I thought, oh, you're kidding me. It's the largest industry? And it's creating the biggest share of new wealth? But it's true. It's the basis of our economy. Next. Wild berries feed no one until someone picks them. New wealth is created by the application of human labor to natural resources. Next. Our cities, industries, and small businesses would not exist without the work of the farmer. It's at the base of everything. Next. So, a parity, what's a parity price for the farmer? Parity prices keep agriculture in balance with the cost of labor and capital in the rest of the economy. So I'm a farmer, I have to buy equipment. I have to go out into that economy and have enough money to buy that equipment. Well, if I'm not given a fair price for my product, I can't do that, right? I want to go to my local rural town and buy from the retailers there. I need things. I need things to run my farm. If I don't have enough money, I can't do that. And his business is going to go out of business, which is what's been happening with forcing family farmers off the land, and the rural towns have been dying. And, and it's a slow, it's a policy that was a slow policy. They planned it out from 1952 to the current. It's still going on. I think today, unfortunately, family farmers are one of the highest sectors of our nation in terms of suicide, because they haven't been able to. They don't want to lose their farms.
It's true globally, in fact.
Is that globally?
Yeah. Okay. As well as the U.S.
Yeah. Okay. So parity. If you give the farmer a good price, a fair price. Norm isn't asking, they don't want billionaire farmers. They just want enough of a price so that a family farmer can continue with his business. But it's even more than that. It's a natural law about the entire economy. So if parity ensures that earned income, so the farmer's earning his income, the people who are making the farm equipment, they're earning their income. The retailer who's selling the farmer equipment, he's earning his income. So if you give the farmer, who's the basis of our economy, a fair price, he'll be able to buy all his stuff that he needs, and the people out in the rest of the economy will have enough money that they've earned. So, next. So gross farm income, so that's, before taking away any costs or anything.
I just want to warn you, we're running out of time.
Oh, how many?
The time is getting short.
How many time?
It's minutes? About 12:22.
But how many minutes do I have?
8 minutes left.
Minutes left for the
entire presentation. That's what I mean.
Well, 8 minutes for the entire presentation. So
we've
got a couple of people who haven't spoken.
Okay. Oh, my goodness. Let me.
We'll only be going into our lunch hour.
So,
it's short term.
So, the income to the farmer, generates our national income. Now, our national income isn't enough today because we're all going into debt to get what we need. But if the farmer was given a fair price, we would all be able to earn enough and wouldn't have to go into the terrible debt that we're in now. Next. I'll skip this. All right, this is, it says, parity prices allows the farmer to buy from rural stores, to purchase his equipment, and to pay his workers good wages. And so, Greens for Monetary Reform, that's a website that explains our platform, Green the Dollar, would distribute public money. That's one way. But parity, giving a parity price, which was implemented federally from 1942 to 1952, that would also distribute the money as earned income through the whole economy. So I'll end there.
So we have a plan for Casey to answer some questions of me from Colorado, Casey Strickland. He works for the National Environmental Protection Agency. And is as the recommendations.
I work for the Department of Energy. I work with the National Environmental Policy Act.
Policy Act, sorry. And so he had some recommendations for What Stephen was looking at as far as regulating from state to state, which states that are not included, I think there's 16 that have no policy act at all. And it's, you know, he has recommendations for how he feels this should go down to the state level as far as conservation and slowing down the climate deterioration process.
Well, and okay. Well, I think that there are 16 states that have their own state regulations for environmental policy. CEQA probably being the most well-known one in California, California Environmental Quality Act. I, being with the federal government, work with the National Environmental Policy Act, which was originally passed in 1969, enacted in 1970, and it's often construed as a way to protect the environment, and that's the hope of how it should work. It was designed to promote a healthier environment, but that's not really the purpose. The purpose is to inform decision makers in the federal government so that environmental is part of the decision. So what ends up happening is it doesn't necessarily lead to the best environmental outcome, but that's fine because the act is just designed to make an informed decision. If there are other reasons to choose a less environmentally appropriate action or more environmentally damaging action, then you choose that. That's the way the federal government works. And so I think there's a misunderstanding of how it works in general, but in general NEPA it's procedural, not prescriptive. So it lays out a procedure that the federal government follows, whatever the outcome may be. It doesn't prescribe what the outcome has to be. So the idea is, well, how do you get involved? I mean, this is kind of about eco action, and as the federal government, the requirement is to put it out there, and it's available for everyone to see and to comment on if it's something you're interested in. Most federal agencies have websites that have all the information, if you can find it. I mean, some make it more difficult than others. But I think for some of the things that Steve was talking about, to move forward into the future, using the National Environmental Policy Act as sort of a base for states is fine, but it probably should be more prescriptive in what it's meant to do. So there's 16 states that have something, and I wouldn't say that they're all necessarily great. CEQA's not a bad one. So as we move forward with some of these ideas that Steve has talked about, be involved. If it's a project that the federal government's involved with or states that have this, you can comment, you can be involved in it, and just kind of work from there. But any of the specific details, it's something that will evolve over a period of time depending on what the project is. There's just too many things. So I guess in general, I'm kind of around for questions if you've got questions about the way the regulations work or the National Environmental Policy Act, but outside of that, it's really more for questions that anybody may have.
So. Thank you. So I had the shelter aspect of our presentation, and I did more of a case study of what's going on in my town of St. Cloud, Minnesota, that I approached it from a mass, the globe should do this and maybe fix our problems perspective. I can tell you that it's more of a, I feel like people are part of the ecology and that we should be included as Sid has said, community is very important. I feel that in order for us to be able to survive as a species, we can't overlook people that are struggling to survive on our way to try to make more profit. And so we have this issue in St. Cloud, Minnesota, where there is no room for the homeless people. We have three different major, and if we don't need this slideshow, I had some issues with uploading my images.
Okay.
Yeah, so we have three major agencies that serve the homeless in St. Cloud. And one of them is Anna Marie's Domestic Abuse Shelter, the Nurse Hope Community Support for Men That Have Drug and Alcohol Issues, and the third is the Salvation Army, which is always brimming over, and people are parked outside looking for places to go. I know I'm taking some people along. We do have coalitions that I'm just now finding out about. There was the St. Cloud Homeless Coalition, which is defunct. But they had an occupant who had been homeless for several years. He was sleeping on a floor at our lake in a bathroom at night. Mm-hmm. So the church, one of the churches, St. John's Episcopal Church, decided that they would try to build them a tiny house. And that's when the war began between the city of St. Cloud and St. John's Episcopal Church. The church actually wound up having to sue the city because they said it was an issue with zoning regulations and that it didn't quite meet standards and that they couldn't place their house there. So the church actually said, this is a separation of church and state. We have a right to minister to the people however we like, and you know, leave us alone, pretty much. And so 3 years later, they have reached a settlement. Briefly, they've reached a settlement to where they had to take out a loan to build a new tiny house, which is 384 square feet to meet the zoning regulations. And the old one is up for sale right now. I did meet and interview some of the people that are involved with this church. They called it the new thing a starfish dwelling, which is based after the fable of One at a Time. The little boy who's on a beach, they tell the stories of the hundreds of starfish left side by side, left by a tide, one at a time, back in the ocean. And a man comes up, and there's a little boy throwing the fish back into the ocean. A man comes up and says, what are you doing? You can't possibly rescue all of those starfish. And he, you know, the kid tosses the starfish back into the ocean and says, well, save that one. So that's where the point of this is. One at a time, they'd like to expand. They're fighting the city that says they don't want 15 of these tiny houses popping up. And so back and forth they go with this. So I did meet with Nancy Dyson, who's involved with Laundry Love. And she's a founder there, and three times a month they wash clothing for people who are homeless and feed a meal so that people at least have clean clothes to wear. We still have a pretty rampant issue. They're estimating there's over 300 homeless children in St. Cloud, Minnesota. There's still issues, of course, with people being able to find places to sleep. The last several months, two people have been dumped into the garbage that were sleeping in enclosures. One of them was back in January. He was compacted four times before they heard him screaming. Fortunately, the garbage was layered in there so well that he did survive. Then there was another one back in April, which the person paying attention to the rearview camera by then saw him get dumped in with the garbage. So it's an issue that we'd like to see solved. Nancy is actually, she's very upper middle class, comes from a very privileged environment, but it's her calling to go out and help people. So she actually, her partner was formerly homeless, and they live in a tiny house between two RVs and a trailer park outside of St. Cloud. So there's a lot of hope for the future, hope to become more active with them. Also on the Equal Action Committee is Frank Jeffers, who was president of an organization called, he's not here, but he was president of an organization called Mad Housers. And they call themselves Guerrilla Housing, where he is an engineer. He designed these panels that could go up within an hour and be taken down within an hour. And they learned in Atlanta, they did, I think it was about 300 again, of these where they would camouflage them in the woods so that they weren't visible from houses. So when people called to complain about the homeless person camping out, they would, you know, come and say, well, did you need that disassembled? Let's get rid of that litter off your property. And then they would take and reconstruct it somewhere else so that people had housing. But we can upload the slide that we have here, the slides that we have, and I can get my images on there as well. And maybe share it to the affairs list for those who are interested in finding links to some of the agencies that were mentioned today and some of the ones some news articles on the things that are going on in my town. Thank you. So are there any questions for anyone?
Were they trying to build like tiny houses around in my area in Washington and stuff too? But it was kind of interesting. Somebody posted a picture from the Everett area down where the paper mill was from back in the Depression, and it was just filled with these little tiny tiny houses with little smokestacks out of all of them. So it's not a new problem, you know, it's a continuation.
There's a place, there's an agency called Community First, and they're trying to get these communities of tiny houses, because a lot of agencies approach it like, you got to get rid of your chemical addiction or whatever, you know, your mental health, before we'll give you a place to live.
Right.
But this agency is saying, no, we need to get people shelter.
Right.
And from there,
all
your other problems can be healed. I know that. We were homeless 4 times. I know that based on experience.
I've been kind of keeping track. Do you want me to point at people?
Okay.
Send her back first.
My question is for Mr. Strickland, Casey.
Yeah.
So would you explain any hierarchy of the hierarchy of the laws or hierarchy of the rules? Like, for example, in some of the states that have their own EPAs or whatever.
Right.
So are states allowed to be more restrictive than federal government, but they can't be less restrictive than the federal laws?
That's pretty much the way it works. States can definitely be more restrictive. California, for instance, is. But they often, that's what you described is exactly how it works. States tend to be more restrictive than the federal government, but no one's really less restrictive. It's just what happens is certain states don't necessarily choose to review things that, say, the federal government would. I mean, if they were to review it, they would probably review it at the same level as the federal government. But there are some states that don't, like, I think Steve mentioned one, was it Georgia, that they don't review state agency actions or something like that?
You know, so some of them have, there's only one that applies to private enterprise. That's only one state, and I don't think it's Georgia.
Yeah, I can't remember which one, but yeah, there's, so different states choose not to necessarily review certain things. And as Steve mentioned, I mean, if it's as far as like the national level or even, you know, we only review if it's federally funded on federal land, requires a federal permit. I mean, if there's no federal action involved, then the federal government doesn't have a right to be involved in it. And so we're not. And so it just depends on what the action is. And some states take the same tact.
I have a similar question about the laws, because in Maryland, we were fighting the first gas export terminal on the East Coast, Cove Point, and it, sadly, it was grandfathered in under old NEPA laws, so they didn't even do a quantitative risk assessment. There's literally no buffer between this facility and a community of almost 2,400 houses. But now they're trying to build compressor stations and feed gas into it. And we were able to organize in the community and get the zoning board to actually deny the zoning permit for the compressor station. Of course, Dominion turned right around and pushed the zoning board again to appeal, you know, to review the decision. And because of community pressure, they refused to review it. They said, no, we've made our decision. But the Maryland Department of the Environment is moving ahead with the permitting process because they are assuming that Dominion will sue them under federal law, and that will preempt the state law, and that even if, you know, Maryland were to not deny the permit, the federal law would, you know, give Dominion the cover to go ahead and go. How do we get around? It's been very frustrating. I've spent the last 4 years fighting Dominion.
There's no real good answer for that because so much now is based on litigation. And
well,
so there, you know, and there's not a real good answer to that, I hate to say.
I saw the answer.
Brianna Baker, State of Indiana. In our neighborhood on Nextdoor, I constantly see neighbors posting about the homeless people that live in the area. And it's kind of heartbreaking to see them call them names when they're going around, like, either asking for water. Sometimes they steal stuff. They steal what they need to survive. And I feel bad about that going on, but I feel even worse that people are going and calling them a bastard or something. It's like, they're not a bad person necessarily. They just need help, and they're doing something that's wrong. But it's like, what can I do to help those in my neighborhood, just as a regular person? Like, how can we even find them?
Join a coalition that is, I would start nationally, like look for a community first, see if they have a chapter in your area. Otherwise, I would talk with the churches. A lot of times they work directly with people, feeding them and different things, that, you know, clothing and things like that. So they'll have references to local agencies and organizations that are working to provide people with shelter. And if you can't get around your city, because, you know, some cities just have that attitude. Well, I worked really hard for what I have, and they should too. And they don't understand what all factors into a person being in a situation at their end. So working with other people that are working on solutions, and you know, whether it be a Madhouser's, you know, that takes it up and puts it down, or whether it be Laundry Love that, you know, is working in a slower fashion towards helping people with the church get housing through tiny houses, and you know, outside of the city zones, right on the border where they can walk at and things like that.
You mentioned that you guys like helped someone get a house. How did you find someone to provide land for that?
And that's always the issue, because even in our city, if it's your private property, you know, if it doesn't meet those zoning regulations, that, you know, it doesn't matter who wants the house. That's the battle between a church. Is the church is saying this is our property, we have the right to minister however we wish, and the city is saying no, you're still within our area. So it's really like what happened with Frank and the people there. They just found wooded areas and they camouflaged them in there until they were found. And then move and relocate them to other wooded areas. And he's recommending also finding right out, you know, finding those zones that are right between the borders of different cities and counties that are kind of gray areas that it would take them a while to decide, you know, which one gets to get people out to place some of these houses.
Yeah.
In most communities, I think you'll probably find the churches are on the front line.
Okay.
Where I live in Appomattox, which is extremely rural but has a tremendous amount of poverty. My church provides over 1,100 meals a month. A neighboring church has this clothing bank. Others deal with the people who can't pay their heating bills. You know, government is not there because of the current political climate. So to the extent that anyone is doing anything, it's private organizations and very often religion-based.
Mm-hmm.
You had your hand.
I was just going to say our green candidate for mayor in the city of Madison was instrumental in getting tiny homes. They purchased a gas station that was a gas station, and then it was a repair station, and it went up for sale, and they purchased it with the idea of putting it in. It's almost like they condoed it, so that the individual houses in there, it came out of the Occupy movement, is what it did. So Occupy Madison morphed into this tiny home village.
Nice.
And the streets people in the city and the police, although they don't like Brenda very much anyway, but streets people and the police actually advocated for this, and it fell within the condo thing, so that it did fight, you know, there was a lot of opposition for the city because, oh, these are individual houses, blah, 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 too small, some of them are 100 square feet, right? And so, they're looking at building or doing a second one. And so there's one in the one neighborhood, excellent neighbors, they have a store in there where the people who live there and other homeless people can come and create added value to things that they find or and are given and are able to sell those things there. It's really changed the city's idea about what housing is and how it can be for, you know, I mean, I'm personally the kind of person that says, well, hell, we're really actually only animals on this planet, and if you can find some place to sleep, you should be able to be there, right? But, cities are regulated.
And ours had to classify, church that the original tiny house is an RV, and they thought they had gotten around everything, and then couldn't find out our city has something in a charter that people cannot sleep in RVs.
Can't live in an RV.
So then they classified it as transitional housing.
Yeah.
Well, you can't stay in transitional housing past 45 days in our city. So there's a constant getting around what they're trying to do to block people from getting this housing in order to be able to move forward to ensure that everyone has a home, right? I think I've read about, you know, Gaddafi in Libya saying nobody should ever have a second home unless everyone has a home first.
Yeah.
So it should be a matter of priority as well as our planet to take care of our people.
Yeah.
Stephen wanted to say something.
In regards to the environmental review process, there are only three states right now that consider carbon emissions as part of their environmental review process. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, individual action, societal, but when you start looking at the political, what can we change in the rules? This is a critical one. You have to get the environmental review process back up and running in every single state and make sure that they include carbon emissions as part of their environmental review process. Because otherwise, you can speak from experience, we just fought back a 9-month battle against one county trying to start fracking. They have about 20,000 plus acres of land that are eligible now for drilling and fracking, and it's right above our aquifer. So the question is that how do we levelize the playing field as far as information? You can't get there from here if you are starting out with a county that has no information available to you, and you're a member of the public and say, okay, what is our noise quality right now in our city, you know, in our rural area? Has it been getting worse? Has it been getting better? What's our air quality been like? Do we review this every 10 or 15 years? Because if you don't do it, California does. If you have major action that's involving a county and they're changing over to do cannabis regulation, that's a major action. And so they have to go through their whole environmental impact review process at that point in time and in consideration of their new regulations and new rules. So it does, to me, it makes a little bit of a difference. Not always, because there's sometimes emissions that are done, but at least it gets you close to where you have a levelized playing field in terms of information, and that's key. And it should be happening all across the country. There should be demands from Greens nationally in the states that don't have their own environmental review process, that they get one up and underway and then include the carbon emissions.
I wanted to add one little thing. I know we're all ready to go, but we often think of climate change and greenhouse gas emissions as one problem and ecosystem collapse as another problem. At root, they're the same problem, and neither one is going to be solved without solving them both. And the solutions coincide to a very great extent. So there's a proposal coming up soon on the NC for a platform amendment for regenerative agriculture, taking us a little bit beyond organic. And those are the kinds of solutions I think we need to really be focusing on. Anyway, any other questions?
Thank you.
I just have a very quick comment. Beyond Extreme Energy is a group that we work very closely with, and we've been targeting the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for the last 4 years because they're the ones that rubber stamp all these oil and gas projects. And it's actually starting to make a difference. We're starting to see some impact on FERC, so check out Beyond Extreme Energy.
In Virginia, there's a huge battle, and our Green Party's in the middle of it.
With the Atlantic Coast Pipeline.
And the Mountain Valley Pipeline, too.
We're involved in that as well. Yeah, good work.
And then in Wisconsin, we've got really, really stringent environmental protections, and then somebody can come in and the legislature says, oh, so that you can make your money and do this and do that.
We'll set it all aside for you.
Right. This many gallons of Lake Michigan in order to make touchscreen TVs.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And feel free to contact any of us in the next couple of days if you'd like to.
I should have had you check it after we did it.
Yeah.
Where to find more?
I thought I had clicked on the correct folder.
Did you say you had a contact? Hi,
Thomas. Those things happen.
I saw your friend in
the
you
know, oh, yeah.
Can I get your contact information?
Sure.
Actually, I want everybody to.